The audible of the best in Bitcoin. This is the Cryptoconomy.
What is up, crew?
Welcome back to the show.
I thank you to Swan Bitcoin for having the best Swan Bitcoin auto buy savings plan that you can set once and forget it. And coming into the halving now, just 5 days away, there is literally no better time to start one than right now. Okay, so I've got kind of a fun read today that's going to be a little surprising probably to anybody who knows of Alan Greenspan and the history of the Fed, because this is in fact written by Alan Greenspan. And it was posted in 1966, and it is titled Gold and Economic Freedom. So without spoiling anything, let's go ahead and just jump right in. Gold and Economic Freedom by Alan Greenspan. An almost hysterical antagonism toward the gold standard is one issue which unites statists of all persuasions. They seem to sense, perhaps more clearly and subtly than many consistent defenders of laissez-faire, that gold and economic freedom are inseparable. That the gold standard is an instrument of laissez-faire, and that each implies and requires the other. In order to understand the source of their antagonism, it is necessary first to understand the specific role of gold in a free society. Money is the common denominator of all economic transactions. It is that commodity which serves as a medium of exchange, is universally acceptable to all participants in an exchange economy as payment for their goods or services, and can therefore be used as a standard of market value and as a store of value, i.e., as a means of savings. The existence of such a commodity is a precondition of a division of labor economy. If men did not have some commodity of objective value which was generally acceptable as money, they would have to resort to primitive barter, or be forced to live on self-sufficient farms and forego the inestimable advantages of specialization. If men had no means to store value, or in other words, to save, neither long-range planning nor exchange would be possible. What medium of exchange will be acceptable to all participants in an economy is not determined arbitrarily. First, the medium of exchange should be durable. In a primitive society of meager wealth, wheat might be sufficiently durable to serve as a medium, since all exchanges will occur only during and immediately after the harvest, leaving no value surplus to store. But where store value considerations are important, as they are in richer, more civilized societies, the medium of exchange must be a durable commodity, usually a metal. A metal is generally chosen because it is homogeneous and divisible. Each unit is the same as every other, and it can be blended or formed in any quantity. Precious jewels, for example, are neither homogeneous nor divisible. More important, the commodity chosen as a medium must be a luxury. Human desires for luxuries are unlimited, and therefore, luxury goods are always in demand and will always be acceptable. Wheat is a luxury in underfed civilizations, but not in a prosperous society. Cigarettes ordinarily would not serve as money, but they did in post-World War II Europe when they were considered a luxury. The term luxury good implies scarcity and high unit value. Having a high unit value, such a good is easily portable. For instance, an ounce of gold is worth a half ton of pig iron. In the early stages of a developing money economy, several media of exchange might be used, since a wide variety of commodities would fulfill the foregoing conditions. However, one of the commodities will gradually displace all others by being more widely acceptable. Preferences on what to hold as a store of value will shift to the most widely acceptable commodity, which in turn will make it still more acceptable. The shift is progressive until that commodity becomes the sole medium of exchange. The use of a single medium is highly advantageous for the same reasons that a money economy is superior to a barter economy. It makes exchanges possible on an incalculably wider scale. Whether the single medium is gold, silver, seashells, cattle, or tobacco is optional, depending on the context and development of a given economy. In fact, all have been employed at various times as media of exchange. Even in the present century, two major commodities, gold and silver, have been used as international media of exchange, with gold becoming the predominant one. Gold, having both artistic and functional uses, and being relatively scarce, has significant advantages over all other media of exchange. Since the beginning of World War I, it has been virtually the sole international standard of exchange. If all goods and services were to be paid for in gold, large payments would be difficult to execute, and this would tend to limit the extent of a society's divisions of labor and specialization. Thus, a logical extension of the creation of a medium of exchange is the development of a banking system and credit instruments, banknotes and deposits, which act as a substitute for, but are convertible into, gold. A free banking system based on gold is able to extend credit and thus to create banknotes, currency, and deposits, according to the production requirements of the economy. Individual owners of gold are induced, by payments of interest, to deposit their gold in a bank, against which they can draw checks. But since it is rarely the case that all depositors want to withdraw all their gold at the same time, the banker need keep only a fraction of his total deposits in gold as reserves. This enables the banker to loan out more than the amount of his gold deposits, which means that he holds claims to gold rather than gold as security of his deposits. But the amount of loans which he can afford to make is not arbitrary. He has to gauge it in relation to his reserves and to the status of his investments. When banks loan money to finance productive and profitable endeavors, the loans are paid off rapidly and bank credit continues to be generally available. But when the business ventures financed by bank credit are less profitable and slow to pay off, bankers soon find that their loans outstanding are excessive relative to their gold reserves, and they begin to curtail new lending, usually by charging higher interest rates. This tends to restrict the financing of new ventures and requires the existing borrowers to improve their profitability before they can obtain credit for further expansion. Thus, under the gold standard, a free banking system stands as the protector of an economy's stability and balanced growth. When gold is accepted as a medium of exchange by most or all nations, an unhampered free international gold standard serves to foster a worldwide division of labor and the broadest international trade. Even though the units of exchange, the dollar, the pound, the franc, etc., differ from country to country, when all are defined in terms of gold, the economies of the different countries act as one, so long as there are no restraints on trade or on the movement of capital. Credit, interest rates, and prices tend to follow similar patterns in all countries. For example, if banks in one country extend credit too liberally, interest rates in that country will tend to fall, inducing depositors to shift their gold to higher interest-paying banks in other countries. This will immediately cause a shortage of bank reserves in the, quote, easy money country, inducing tighter credit standards and a return to competitively higher interest rates again. A fully free banking system and fully consistent gold standard have not as yet been achieved. But prior to World War I, the banking system in the United States and in most of the world was based on gold, and even though governments intervened occasionally, banking was more free than controlled. Periodically, as a result of overly rapid credit expansion, banks became loaned up to the limit of their gold reserves, interest rates rose sharply, new credit was cut off, and the economy went into a sharp but short-lived recession. Compared with the depressions of 1920 and 1932, the pre-World War I business declines were mild indeed. It was limited gold reserves that stopped the unbalanced expansions of business activity before they could develop into the post-World War I type of disaster. The readjustment periods were short, and the economies quickly reestablished a sound basis to resume expansion. But the process of cure was misdiagnosed as the disease.
If shortage of bank reserves was causing a business decline, argued economic interventionists, why not find a way of supplying increased reserves to the banks so they never need to be short?
If banks can continue to loan money indefinitely, it was claimed, there need never be any slumps in business. And so, the Federal Reserve System was organized in 1913. It consisted of 12 regional Federal Reserve banks nominally owned by private bankers, but in fact government-sponsored, controlled, and supported. Credit extended by these banks is in practice, though not legally, backed by the taxing power of the federal government. Technically, we remained on the gold standard. Individuals were still free to own gold, and gold continued to be used as bank reserves. But now, in addition to gold, credit extended by the Federal Reserve banks, paper reserves, could serve as legal tender to pay depositors. When business in the United States underwent a mild contraction in 1927, the Federal Reserve created more paper reserves in the hope of forestalling any possible bank reserve shortage. More disastrous, however, was the Federal Reserve's attempt to assist Great Britain, who had been losing gold to us because the Bank of England refused to allow interest rate to rise when market forces dictated. It was politically unpalatable. The reasoning of the authorities involved was as follows. If the Federal Reserve pumped excess paper reserves into American banks, interest rates in the United States would fall to a level comparable with those in Great Britain. This would act to stop Britain's gold loss and avoid the political embarrassment of having to raise interest rates. The Fed succeeded. It stopped the gold loss, but it nearly destroyed the economies of the world in the process. The excess credit which the Fed pumped into the economy spilled over into the stock market, triggering a fantastic speculative boom. Belatedly, Federal Reserve officials attempted to sop up the excess reserves and finally succeeded in breaking the boom, but it was too late. By 1929, the speculative imbalances had become so overwhelming that the attempt precipitated a sharp retrenching and a consequent demoralizing of business confidence. As a result, the American economy collapsed. Great Britain fared even worse, and rather than absorb the full consequences of her previous folly, she abandoned the gold standard completely in 1931, tearing asunder what remained of the fabric of confidence and inducing a worldwide series of bank failures. The world economies plunged into the Great Depression of the 1930s. With a logic reminiscent of a generation earlier, statists argued that the gold standard was largely to blame for the credit debacle which led to the Great Depression.
If the gold standard had not existed, they argued, Britain's abandonment of gold payments in 1931 would not have caused the failure of banks all over the world.
The irony was that since 1913, we had been not on a gold standard, but on what may be termed a mixed gold standard. Yet it was gold that took the blame. But the opposition to the gold standard in any form, from a growing number of welfare state advocates, was prompted by a much subtler insight. the realization that the gold standard is incompatible with chronic deficit spending, the hallmark of the welfare state. Stripped of its academic jargon, the welfare state is nothing more than a mechanism by which governments confiscate the wealth of the productive members of a society to support a wide variety of welfare schemes. A substantial part of the confiscation is affected by taxation. But the welfare statists were quick to recognize that if they wished to retain political power, the amount of taxation had to be limited, and they had to resort to programs of massive deficit spending. In other words, they had to borrow money by issuing government bonds to finance welfare expenditures on a large scale. Under a gold standard, the amount of credit that an economy can support is determined by the economy's tangible assets, since every credit instrument is ultimately a claim on some tangible asset. But government bonds are not backed by tangible wealth, only by the government's promise to pay out of future tax revenues, and cannot easily be absorbed by the financial markets. A large volume of new government bonds can be sold to the public only at progressively higher interest rates. Thus, government deficit spending under a gold standard is severely limited. The abandonment of the gold standard made it possible for the welfare status to use the banking system as a means to an unlimited expansion of credit. They have created paper reserves in the form of government bonds, which, through a complex series of steps, the banks accept in place of tangible assets and treat as if they were an actual deposit. In other words, as the equivalent of what was formerly a deposit of gold. The holder of a government bond or of a bank deposit created by paper reserves believes that he has a valid claim on a real asset. But the fact is that there are now more claims outstanding than real assets. The law of supply and demand is not to be conned. As the supply of money, of claims, increases relative to the supply of tangible goods in the economy, prices must eventually rise. Thus, the earnings saved by the productive members of the society lose value in terms of goods. When the economy's books are finally balanced, one finds that this loss in value represents the goods purchased by the government for welfare or other purposes with the money proceeds of the government bonds financed by bank credit expansion. In the absence of the gold standard, there is no way to protect savings from confiscation through inflation. There is no safe store of value. If there were, the government would have to make its holding illegal, as was done in the case of gold. If everyone decided, for example, to convert all his bank deposits to silver or copper or any other good, and thereafter declined to accept checks as payment for goods, bank deposits would lose their purchasing power, and government-created bank credit would be worthless as a claim on goods. The financial policy of the welfare state requires that there be no way for the owners of wealth to protect themselves. This is the shabby secret of the welfare statist tirades against gold. Deficit spending is simply a scheme for the confiscation of wealth. Gold stands in the way of this insidious process. It stands as a protector of property rights. If one can grasp this, one has no difficulty in understanding the statist antagonism toward the gold standard. Now, for anybody who knows Alan Greenspan's legacy as chairman of the Federal Reserve, you would probably be surprised if you didn't already know that this was written by him. His legacy could not be more antithetical to what he wrote in this piece. And it's crazy to, well, you know what, I don't want to get into it. Let's go ahead and talk about our sponsor for a minute, and then we'll get into Guy's take on this piece. And our sponsor for today is Swan Bitcoin. You know, these guys are true Bitcoiners to the core, And now that I'm actually a part of the team over there, I get to see just how furiously they are working to make this available and as simple as humanly possible for you. And without even taking into account the improvements that are coming down the line, they have the best and lowest cost auto DCA out there. For starting your Bitcoin savings plan, there is no better option than swanbitcoin.com. You simply set a purchase every week, every paycheck, every month, whatever works best for you in whatever amount you want to do, and you set an auto withdrawal to your own keys, and it stacks for you indefinitely. You set it and forget it. Start your savings plan if you haven't yet at swanbitcoin.com and put that /guy on the end of it if you love me and want to support the Audible of the Bitcoin space. Thanks to the guys at Swan Bitcoin for supporting this show. So, this piece, though, it's amazing how well he understood everything that he was doing to destroy the economy while he was chairman of the Federal Reserve. And what's really funny is how he talks in this. Like, he clearly has a terrible distaste, like just spite for the Federal Reserve system in general. And I mean, he calls them statists throughout the whole thing. Is it like the argument that statists make? He talks like a freaking anarchist. And it's just kind of crazy to hear Greenspan. And I have read some of his earlier works, and there are other things. Like, he has a piece on the Great Depression that really digs into the cause and the effect, the consequences of all the stuff that he did in brief in like a paragraph or two in this piece, which I encourage you to if you want to get like a accurate history of the Great Depression and the monetary imbalances from an Austrian perspective, there are a number of great pieces out there, and I'll try to grab one or two or whatever to link to if you'd like to dig into that. So that'll be in the show notes. But more specifically, it's just to hear him talk with such certainty and specifically about that the gold standard is inseparable from freedom. One of the little sections I grabbed was that the gold standard is an instrument of laissez-faire, and that each implies and requires the other. So this is such a great illustration to understand that we do not have free markets. And the corruption and control, doesn't matter what freedom we have to make choices, if those choices aren't based on actual market information, the corruption and control of our money alone is more than enough to concretely know that we do not have accurate market signals. And not only is it like enough, quote unquote, it is literally the greatest single thing that could be controlled in order to take away a free market. Even violent control or enforcement of a bunch of arbitrary and totalitarian laws is more likely to lead to a growing black market where real prices still exist. But if we're talking about the manipulation of money itself, not even that avenue of the market is left available. Everything is distorted. And I love that he really just goes into the fundamental idea of what a money is, of why gold is money, and how it's the universal store of value that ends up becoming the medium of exchange, that because of its ability to store value, its scarcity, it's, you know, divisibility, and without saying the word fungible, he says all the units are the same, and you can divide it into tiny amounts, or, you know, add it into great amounts, and it's the same thing, you know, regardless of the amount. Whereas obviously you can't do that with jewelry or like jewels and gems and, you know, that sort of stuff. You know, that's just basic fungibility and then portability, that you can move it around and exchange it, and that, you know, this good, as this good emerges in society, it becomes that medium of exchange. And that the, like, he says the existence of such a commodity is a precondition for a division of labor economy. You can't actually have specialization. You cannot facilitate exchange on that scale without a sound, reliable monetary standard. Society as we know it cannot exist without that monetary base. And it's just so crazy to hear Greenspan iterating these ideas, you know, before he basically took a dump on all of them as chairman of the Federal Reserve. And he even talks about the, like, briefly about, like, kind of the network effects, about the, about how it is that in order to create, like, this is so funny that I'll actually, I'll find the quote here, but that he uses the exact, something that can apply so well to Bitcoin and where we are now, is that, here it is. In the early stages of a developing money economy, several media of exchange might be used, since a wide variety of commodities would fulfill the foregoing conditions. However, one of the commodities will gradually displace all others by being more widely acceptable. And then, you know, even just the fact that it begins to become more widely accepted makes it more widely acceptable. And this is where you get the network effects and mutual exclusivity of money that is such a powerful force for a single dominant monetary standard, is that you cannot hold it in anything, you cannot hold value in one thing, in more than one thing at a time. It is by its necessity something that is exclusive to a single location or a single good, or it's not actual value. That's something inherent to the nature of value. So, like, even the most powerful network effects that we see that make it, you know, so freaking difficult to make an alternative to Twitter, because its network effect is so powerful in social media, and with Facebook, same story there. And then, like, the network effect of something like a language, you know, you could make, English has all kinds of problems. English is a horrible language, is confusing, it's got so many contradictions, the rules are not at all consistent. We've got 10 different words for the same meaning, and then we've got, you know, some words that mean 5 different things depending on the context. And if you've ever heard that segment by, was it George Carlin or something? I think it's George Carlin. The segment where he just goes on and on about all the ridiculous contradictions of the spellings and the meanings and the pronunciations of all these words that should, you know, if there was actually a consistent set of rules, you know, would be entirely different. And he walks through this whole thing. It's a hilarious skit. But anyway, you know, English is a highly flawed language, but you can't just invent a new language and think that, oh, well, we're just going to push English out of the way because ours is, you know, incrementally better. We solved the ridiculousness of the fact that numb is spelled N-U-M-B and some is spelled S-O-M-E. Yeah, that does not spell success for your language, no matter how much you market how stupid that rule is. But those are even network effects. Those network effects are powerful, without a doubt. But those are even network effects that aren't mutually exclusive. You can know 3 languages, 10 languages. Like, it's hard and it's slow to, you know, adopt the new one, but you can. You can know English and Spanish and French all at the exact same time, despite the fact that you may, you know, choose to use one over the other most of the time. You can have accounts on multiple social networks, almost, you know, the vast majority of people do. They have accounts at all of the major social networks. Yet those network effects are still that powerful. Now imagine you have a money, one where the very nature of the fact that other people are accepting it makes it a better money, and where to hold any value in a different money is putting that value at risk of the adoption of the other. And this is why, like, and he talks about, like, it's at the very heart of what makes a monetary instrument, of what makes an economy possible. That no matter what you get at the end, the advantages of using a common universal money vastly outweigh any minute benefit of one over the other. And that's why the network effects of money are so much more powerful than any other anything to compare it to. And it's why money always leads to a dominant standard. I mean, we have it now. Even though people think of it as fiat money and, oh, we have all our nations have their own currencies and we have this huge plethora of currencies, that's not really true. What we have is exchange rates based on the dollar. The dollar is the world reserve currency. And it's not even like, oh, it's really close with another. No, it is overwhelmingly the standard, end of story. And it is the basis of all international trade. And this is why tokens are all garbage. No matter what perceived, you know, I mean, ignore a whole bunch of the other reasons, but no matter what, if whatever the service, the smart contract, the application, whatever it is, can be done on anything, is even remotely possible on anything other than their specific blockchain, then it will not capture any value whatsoever in the long run. Because that token, whatever, you know, thing that they are trying to sell, digital point that they are trying to sell as a medium of exchange for their one service or their one network or their one smart contract or whatever stupid thing it is, it cannot escape having to compete with Bitcoin's monetization. And it's so obviously clear that Bitcoin is the reserve currency of the crypto space, and it's because of its independence. And remember, even Greenspan says in this piece that it's the banking system and payment networks that make it a medium of exchange, not the fact that you can physically exchange gold. The ability to exit, to redeem with gold reliably, which is what was lost, is what keeps the prices in check, is what makes the payment system worth a payment system, is actually makes it valuable. So, and particularly in the cryptographic system, in the consensus system that we have around Bitcoin, the fact that auditing that data is a requirement to its independence and security, sacrificing everything that makes it trustless to get cheap payments on the base layer, while there are literally a limitless number of things that we can build on top of it to solve that problem a million different ways. Like Parker Lewis says in Bitcoin is Too Slow, is the payments problem, the trustless, independent Bitcoin scarcity problem, the independent, immovable monetary policy problem, is a 0-1 invention. Payments are a 1-2. It is a never-ending task, and there is no one immediate solution. It is just a constant state of iterations and expansions and new inventions and new tools. Scaling payments will never be done. So sacrificing the fundamental characteristics, the actual monetary policy, which this whole piece is talking about, that is what defends the market from these terrible imbalances, from these speculative, crazy speculative bubbles and the confiscation of wealth from productive people. That's the monetary policy. The independence and the security of that is the fundamental thing that makes all of the other stuff possible. And he talks about even during the gold standard, that the units of exchange that were used, like the dollar, the pound, the franc, etc., even though it appeared as if there were all these different currencies, the international markets worked in exchanging them explicitly because they were defined in the international market in terms of how much gold they were worth. I mean, that's what the pound was. It was weight. So the economies of all of these different countries can transmit value, can communicate value as if they are one economy. And the ability to redeem gold and move it to another country, that's how these things were kept in check. that as long as there were no restraints on trade or the movement of capital, these broad international markets would act as one. And if there was ever an easy money policy in country A, well, then immediately the wealthy people could take their gold, they could redeem their gold, take it out of that economy and move it to an economy that will get them a better interest rate. And it has the act, it immediately does the balancing act of pushing those interest rates up in that country by removing reserves, and it's basically setting a global interest rate, a stable, sustainable interest rate policy that, without the restrictions on the flow of capital, can always be maintained. And again, the economy behaves, or the globe behaves, as a single unit, a single economy. He says toward the end of that section that under the gold standard, like as a consequence of all of this, under the gold standard, a free banking system stands as the protector of an economy's stability and balanced growth. How on earth is he the one that lowered interest rates to cause the dot-com bubble? This is where I think the guy is just 100% culpable, and why the political expediency of any institution that's run by a government or an elite that basically has monopolistic control, no matter who you put in charge, that thing is doomed. There's no way they can act in the best interest of the economy, because political interest will always go against making uncomfortable decisions. I mean, he explained perfectly in this short little segment in 1966 how he caused a massive economic and stock market bubble in the late 90s, which resulted in a phenomenal crash. And then, of course, we propped up with a housing bubble. We solved the first bubble with a different credit bubble, and that went into housing. And then we solved that bubble with a third bubble, the everything bubble that we are currently crashing and or trying to prop back up, with all of these same problems that he details out here. And this section is why a Bitcoin standard is so amazing. You know, like, I don't think, like, even as he says during the dollar, during the gold standard, we still had the dollar, the pound, the franc, et cetera, but they behaved as their relative value to gold. It was their peg to gold that mattered and allowed for an efficient international and sustainable market. And this is why I don't think national currencies are going anywhere. You know, I don't think nationalism and patriotism is just going to like up and vanish one day. But those national currencies that want to participate in the greatest market for exchange in the world, the one with the most socially scalable, which he actually refers to in this without actually hitting the term socially scalable, but that he talks about as its acceptance and its ability to be easily recognized and understood as a valuable by the largest number of people, which is essentially what socially scalable is that its independence, its lack of counterparty risk, its verification, its all the characteristics that make it able for one person to trust its value, has scope across, like, no cultural barriers, no jurisdictions. All of these things are less important. The less important all of those arbitrary and subjective things are, the better it is socially scalable, because even people who speak totally different languages and under totally different governments, under totally different laws, and, on opposite sides of the earth, can still equally identify and trust this one independent medium, and they don't have to worry about what the other person's situation is. That's the most socially scalable thing, and that's a beautiful place for Bitcoin, because there is nothing as easily verifiable and socially scalable as an independent and full audit of the system. I mean, that's down to the very individual level for anyone who has a computer. That makes it one of the most powerful potential medium of exchanges and stores of value, one that's it's indifferent to restraints on trade and capital controls. So in a Bitcoin standard world, those currencies hold value explicitly due to how quickly you can redeem it to gold, to the international standard, whatever that international standard is. And the fact that Bitcoin is inherently international, like not even like, oh, it's international, but that it genuinely cannot know about or restrict for national borders, even if it was tried. The basis of the consensus system is that it would literally create a fork. It can't care about borders, about national borders. And that this thing is growing in cyberspace absent of the banking system. That it has its own, it already has extra national markets by the nature of its origin and the very ground that it occupies. The likelihood that simply if it survives, that it could become the standard is unbelievably potent. And, you know, it's the fact that it's so easy to restrict the movement of gold that allows some countries to get away with low interest rates, even during something like a gold standard, is that if you could institute heavy restrictions and heavy capital controls and not let people redeem their gold or not let people move it, you know, put it on a plane and ship it across the country or the ocean, I mean, because moving gold is hard, slow, almost always permissioned, and costs an absolute fortune, that it can't keep these international markets in check. It couldn't even then. It led to these imbalances simply because capital controls were very easy to place on gold. They were physically in the jurisdiction. Gold can't not pretend there are jurisdictions. It has the exact opposite problem of Bitcoin. So what happens when there's a commodity that is more scarce, has absolutely no idea and could not care less that countries exist, that the protocol is entirely independent and censorship resistant, that anybody in the world can download the software and check and independently know its integrity for themselves individually, and that to move potentially $1 trillion out of a country, it still just takes a 10-minute block and one Bitcoin transaction from the comfort of whatever trillionaire's home it happens to be in. I mean, think about it. If gold managed to keep any of this in check at all, Bitcoin is necessarily 100 times more effective at it. You know, there's a number of other things that I wanted to talk about, but I'm a little bit running out of time. Like, as he goes through, like, what happened in the Great Depression about, you know, letting Great Britain to save themselves embarrassment by manipulating the interest rates, and then, you know, they destroyed the economies of the world. Like, this is, golly, that, you know, politics is just so destructive. I mean, any system where political expediency to save a little embarrassment costs the lives of millions of people, the health of everyone, the livelihood and the very security of the entire world economy that feeds and clothes and, you know, gives life to all of us, that is in any way subject to the ego of a politician who would really prefer not to have to make a public uncomfortable decision. You know, if there was a series of exhibits of, you know, of evidence on why the separation of money and state is an absolute necessity for a prosperous and sustainable future, it would genuinely extend to the ends of the earth. Having a system that could even entertain such a horrifically asymmetric cost is hilariously idiotic. If we design anything at all for any reason with a systemic way in which someone's nervousness or uncomfort with having to tell an uncomfortable truth could cause economic catastrophe, then that is the stupidest system we could ever put a dollar's worth of value into. And Greenspan uses a beautiful set of words about what all this even means. This was so great, was the law of supply and demand is not to be conned. That's just an awesome quote. It's a con on supply and demand, on a law of nature. And understand, you know, the law of supply and demand is a law because it is a law of nature. You know, it is as true and certain as the laws of physics. The law of supply and demand is a consequence of any time that demand for something exists. So if there is a desire or a need for a system, a living system, to have something, the law of supply and demand is there. There is no escaping it. It's as true for bacteria and dinosaurs as it is for humans. You know, if there's a species of, you know, ancient organism or dinosaur, you know, whatever it is, that needs the food of a single prey, and then there's many of this species, and there's barely a handful of their prey left in existence, well, then the price, obviously not a monetary price, but the price of obtaining that limited supply of prey is extraordinarily high, potentially costing them their entire life. It's a game of life or death in competition with all others who demand it in comparison to its available supply. It's always present, and it is not something that you can just cover up and pretend it goes away, for the exact same reason that you can't just push a bunch of people out of a plane and be like, well, I'm the most important person on the plane, and I say gravity doesn't exist. Well, guess what? None of those people are miraculously going to be able to fly because you think that. It's just so, it's so arrogant. And, you know, Greenspan even, like, suggests in this that it's conscious, you know, like they know that underneath it all is the fact that they can't steal from people if they have to have sound money. That they know they are limited in how much wealth they can confiscate from the average person. Quote, you know, the financial policy of the welfare state requires that there be no way for owners of wealth to protect themselves. There's just no alternative. Otherwise, they don't have the political power because people actually see where the cost is going. It's only because they can hide it in inflation and, of course, distribute it all over the world if you have the world reserve currency that you can even sustain it. And even he kind of alludes to in this piece, you know, the fight that inevitably comes with this, which I don't want to end this on a negative note, but, you know, like it's the very survival of what is the political status quo, the very survival of what we think of as the role of government in society depends on not having sound money. And they're, you know, if for what they're willing to do over the scare of a virus, what do you think they would be willing to do to save the very idea of government authority to manipulate what we do, to move things around in the economy and to pick winners and losers, to bail out their cronies and, you know, the wealthy elite and all of their buddies, and to give subsidies and contracts to all of their biggest donors and families, and to buy votes from everybody below, you know, said poverty line, that we'll give you an unlimited amount, we'll give you UBI, we'll, you know, you won't have to work if things are tough, you know, like, you don't have to produce, we'll pay you, and it's the evil producers that are keeping you poor. I mean, you know, that sort of thing is the power to move the world. And when you've already shown that you're willing to use that power however seems convenient to you, they're not going to just roll over.
And, you know, Andrea said this recent episode with Bitcoin & Co. You know, we talk about this a lot, but there is a fight coming. They're not going to just roll over and let this happen. And it will be very, very interesting. Like, again, this is going to be some of the most crazy times to be alive, to see the unraveling of all of this, which is what we're in the middle of watching, essentially. So, you know, get it while the getting's good. start your Swan Bitcoin savings plan and start stacking sats however you can, because we are headed into a sound money future is inevitable. And I mean, it's the only reasonable path forward. If you don't invest in it, then you're just investing in the alternative. You're, you know, like I've said before, is that we have two paths on this. We have the Chinese damn like communist surveillance state, essentially, where they dictate everything about our money and our habits and our behaviors by controlling the entire incentive structure of investment and time preference, as they have been doing, and they only crack down harder. You know, we're moving into the digital age. That means that we will either get back our privacy through cryptography and independent protocols and systems like Bitcoin and I don't know, Tor and, you know, encryption, all of these things. We'll either get it back or we will by default lose it. Those are the only two options. So, you know, like, even if we go down the bad path, do you want to be one of the ones that said, yeah, I invested in this, and even though there was an alternative, I never supported it. I never saw that it was valuable or that there was any reason to save privacy and independence for the future. I don't know. That's not something I want to be. I want to have to say. All right. I'm out. I'm about to jump on a chat with a couple of guys. I think this will be really fun. I got some stuff coming soon, so keep an ear out. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to check out Swan Bitcoin. Love those guys for supporting the Audible of the Bitcoin space. And if you do go over there, don't forget to put /guy at the end. That's swanbitcoin.com/guy. And they will know that I was, in fact, the one that sent them there. Because you love me and I appreciate it massively. Subscribe to the show and share it out with everybody you know in the Bitcoin and crypto economy space. And until next time, guys, take it easy.